I'm Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke, the 10th man to walk on the moon. And you got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. This is the Space Show, Australia, on 88.3 Southern FM.
And we have gone beyond blue because, yes, Charlie Duke dropped into Southern FM here and gave us a very long interview. And we have had to break it up into three parts. And this evening, we're going to have the third of our three conversations with Charlie Duke. We had chatted last week about what he did on the moon and some of the things that he did when he returned. And then eventually he left NASA. And I, you know, asked him, what did he do in that time? Since leaving NASA, in the 40 years it pretty much is since he left NASA, he's done an amazing number of things. And he just skimped over them during our conversation, but they are really, really quite remarkable, the sorts of things that he has done. So, here we go, our conversation with Charlie Duke. Now, it's nearly 40 years since you left NASA. Mm-hmm. What have you been doing since then?
Well, after I left NASA, I went into... I didn't have enough time in the military to finish retirement, so I went in part-time into the military Air Force Reserve, served at Randolph Air Force Base in San Antonio until I retired in 1986. But also during that time, I was running a beverage business, and then I went into some real estate development. Then we began to develop our Christian ministry. My wife and I had this encounter with Jesus, and it was life-changing, really. And it changed our marriage and our lives so profoundly that we just wanted to go tell everybody about it. And our diocese and our parish heard the story, and well, you ought to hear this Charlie Duke. He's got a great story about the moon and then walking with the Lord. So it was sort of walk on the moon, walk with the the sun, S-O-N. And we're still doing that now. We've been all over the world sharing our faith and hopefully inspiring a lot of people. And one of the reasons we're here in Melbourne now is to speak to schools. We've been to, let's see, seven schools, no, eight schools now, and we got six more to do before we depart. And spoke to two groups today, both 1,000 kids. And, you know, if you can change one life and motivate one person, it's all worth it. So we do that. And also I am involved now in motivational speaking. I do stuff for organizations, associations, individual companies. Work for the Omega Watch, Embraer, the Brazilian airplane maker. And I do, so there I speak to management teams, and it's teamwork, delivering under pressure, importance of thorough planning, preparation, and you do good planning and preparation, the outcome usually works out. Mm-hmm. And so, because you can handle all contingencies, you can handle everything. And so I found that very motivating to me now.
Now, how do you find these school children here in Melbourne have been receiving your message?
Tremendous. Everybody is listening. Most of my audience is from teenagers, from like 13 to 18. Though I've spoken to one younger group. And everybody just sort of sit there and thoroughly entertained and excited, and the girls seem to be more excited than the boys. You know, they're more exuberant and more demonstrative of their emotions than guys are. But everybody gives me a good standing, not a standing ovation, but a good ovation, And many have come up, said it's the best assembly we've ever had. And so thank you for coming. So I've been very pleased with the response.
Now, do you still follow the space program?
Yeah, I sure do.
And what are your thoughts on it, the way it's going?
Unfortunately, I'm in very disappointed in the manned program. The unmanned program, the robotics and stuff, seems to be going pretty good. But the manned program is suffering. We don't have any way to get to space. And so we're flying on the Russian Soyuz, costing us a lot of money. They can't do it without us, and we can't do it without them because we don't have any way to get there to the space station without the Soyuz. I'm delighted to see the Orion, the manned program that NASA is working on, have some life to it, and I just hope they would accelerate the schedule. Now it's 4 or 5 years before we have the first manned flight, and then
several years between flights.
Yeah.
And you were talking a moment ago about doing Apollos every 2 months.
At first we were. Then it turned out, you know, once a year or so. Mm. But and so I'm disappointed at the pace of the program. We have Orion, which can carry six. It's like Apollo on steroids. And I think it's going to be a good machine because it has an escape system and it can go into deep space. Some people are pushing for a flyby of Mars with the Orion, which I think would be a good mission. But it's, you know, 2020 maybe. NASA has some good signs, though. NASA's just committed to the Space Launch System, which is a big new heavy lift vehicle that is going to be developed that initially carry 100 tons into space and payload, and then up to 130 with the follow-on improvements. So that's Apollo Saturn V stuff, you know, and which I think is going to be good. We, at least we'll have a spacecraft and a launch vehicle to do that, and hopefully we can get some leadership to commit to either return to moon to establish a moon station with cycle crews back and forth, and then eventually on to Mars. And I think eventually we'll see a Mars attempt. I probably won't be around when they do it, but I think the human spirit is just to go to Mars. And it's a God-given, inquisitive spirit that we have to discover what's inside the atom, to discover what's underneath the sea, and discover what's out there in space. And so I think that's just going to take us there.
There's been an argument, of course, whether we should go back to the moon before Mars or do asteroids. What are your thoughts on that?
I think we ought to go to the moon again and build build a station or moon base, whatever you want to call it, and there we develop the systems that can last for long duration. Because if we went directly to Mars without any history and experience on these systems, you're on your own. Mm-hmm. And you can't get any help from Houston at Mars. You know, it's too long of transmission, and so you're autonomous. And we need systems that we have tested, relied upon, and developed, and I think that the moon is the place to do that. And plus, we can do, there's a lot of benefits of going back to the moon science-wise. And Jack Schmidt wants to go start learning how we can mine helium-3 on the moon, which is a tremendous power source, which eventually might be useful here on Earth. So,
okay.
But I'm not much on the asteroid mission. I think that's a waste, personally.
Okay. And we have had Jack Schmidt on the space show talking about his ideas on mining helium on the moon and how it could be used as an energy source here on Earth. Now, last week we played the first words that were said on the moon by the Apollo 16 crew, John Young and Charlie Duke. And here's what Charlie Duke had to say as they lifted off from the moon, heading back towards the command module and then on towards the Earth. Now, during the trip back to Earth, during the several days they took to come from the moon back towards the Earth, the press were allowed to ask questions. Now, in those days, the only person who could talk to the astronauts was the capsule communicator, another astronaut, and the reporters could not ask questions directly. Now, that rule has changed in the days of the space station, but in those days, in 1972, the reporters could not ask the questions directly. This is some of the clips from that press conference, and the first was a comment on the rocks found on the moon and whether or not they had been surprised by it.
Question number three in three parts. Were you surprised at the rocks and other formations at the Cayley site?
I think we were. The original impression had been mostly volcanics to look for, and I don't think we found the highest percentage of volcanics as we had originally anticipated. So the rocks that we found were unique, that we had never seen before in any of the lunar samples, we feel, and so it was a surprise.
And the astronauts spoke more about the volcanic rocks that they had found on the moon.
Did you see anything specifically volcanic?
As far as craters go, Hank, we think we saw two that have the shape, we called endogenic, that have the shape of very subdued old cinder cones or something of that nature. They were, in other words, they were looked more like sinkholes, really, with the surrounding topography. They had no rim on them, and to us it looked like it might have been a source for some a volcanic activity way back.
The lunar module that they landed on the moon with was called Orion, and the command service module was named CASPER. Well, after docking with CASPER in lunar orbit, Orion's crew vacuumed the cabin interior until their vacuum cleaner failed. This left fine dust floating across from the lunar module and into the command module. Mission Control had planned to have the crew get some sleep before jettisoning the lunar module, a change from the original flight plan. The crew were annoyed that Houston had altered their timelines. After the sleep period, a large number of checklist and timeline changes were voiced up to the crew. The annotations made these documents into a very messy condition. In the confusion, the crew left a switch in Orion in the wrong position. The plan had been for CASPER and Orion to separate, then for a command to be sent to fire Orion's reaction control system to deorbit the lunar module. It would crash into the moon, giving a data point of known energy and location to the seismometers left on the moon by earlier Apollo astronauts. However, when Orion was jettisoned from CASPER, it began slowly tumbling. It was inhibited from operating its maneuvering engines because of the switch position. A few minutes after releasing Orion, Ken Mattingly fired thrusters to move CASPER away from the ascent stage. Ken Mattingly, by the way, was the man who remained aboard the CASPER spacecraft as it orbited the moon while the other two went down to the moon's surface. Well, 6 hours later, CASPER's main engine was ignited to propel Apollo 16 out of lunar orbit to return to Earth. Orion remained orbiting the moon for nearly a year before it naturally crashed into the lunar surface. The media, of course, wanted to know a bit about this, and they had this question to ask about the failure of the Orion to go down to the moon immediately.
Question 10. Could you explain the circumstances surrounding the failure of the lunar module ascent stage to deorbit?
I think that has to be worked out when we looked at all the data on the ground and discuss it with the flight controllers. At the present time, I have no idea.
No, I don't either.
In the next question, all three crew members were asked to reply, and in this comment, Duke will be the first to speak, then Mattingly, and then finally, John Young.
Question 12 for each of you. What do you hope to tell your grandchildren as your most memorable moment of your trip to the moon?
Well, I'll start with that one, Hank. I have two impressions. The first is the dazzling beauty of the cart, the surface. It was just one of the most awe-inspiring sights I've ever seen. And secondly, on the EVA, when you look away from the Earth or the moon, it's just the utter blackness of space. It really is black out there.
Time number 53, he said that.
Well, I guess I'm next, and I thought I knew someone would ask that question, and I've been asking that question too. And I don't think I can put an impression. There's so many that we've crammed in the last 12 days. It seems like each one comes on top of the other one, and the immediate response that you come up with is, that's the most fantastic thing I've ever seen. And in a lot of respects, it really is. There have been so many events and so many sights that in my case, I'm going to have to sit and think about this one for a long time before I can ever pick out one. And I'm not sure I'll ever be able to say that there was a unique thing or a most memorable event. The whole thing has been just one series of very impressive and, I hate to use the word, but I don't know anything else except to say it's fantastic.
I think Kent's got the answer. I think we've seen as much in 10 days as most people see in 10 lifetimes. And we certainly have enjoyed it.
A very happy crew member on the way back from the moon. They had spent 3 days driving around the Descartes area of the moon, and John Young had this comment to make about that area.
Well, let me just say one thing, and that is Mr. Descartes said it. He said, there's nothing so far removed from us as to be beyond our reach, or so hidden that we cannot discover it. And you'll know Descartes was a French mathematician and philosopher for whom the region was named. And I guess really the story of our mission so far is we've been out testing this theory. My personal assessment of where we are right now, as soon as we get the rocks back in the LRL, we'll be making headway toward proving he was right.
Another member of the press wanted to know whether or not the crew had thought they had adequate training before their mission.
Shape and softness and friability and things like that, and that really doesn't take a lot of training, but I think we've had adequate training to do this kind of job.
Well, the crew, after several days traveling back towards the Earth and falling most of the way, of course, under the Earth's gravity, and hit the atmosphere at about 40,000 kilometres per hour, about 11 kilometres per second, and they made an entry through the atmosphere and then opened the parachutes and they parachuted down into the Pacific Ocean. And the splashdown occurred 1,700 kilometres south of Hawaii, 2,000 kilometres east of the Marshall Islands, and 2,600 kilometres northeast of Samoa. And that was just north of the equator. And they had entered the atmosphere, by the way, over Samoa at an altitude of 120 kilometres. Well, before Charlie came into Southern FM, we had asked many of our listeners to pose questions. What would you want us to ask Charlie Duke? And Peter was the one who put the questions to Charlie. Now, Peter has been gathering some questions from our listeners, and I'll hand over to Peter.
Thanks, Andrew. We'll just do a couple. I know you've had a long day, yeah. Charlie. Some of our listeners have sent in questions from Colin Burgess, who actually is a co-author of a book.
Yeah, I know Colin.
Oh, you know Colin?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With Kate Doolan, who did the book Fallen Astronauts, that you may or may not be familiar with. He's asked if you could have flown on another of the six Apollo landing missions instead of yours, which one would it be and why?
I would have loved to have gone on a 17. A 16 was a fabulous mission. It was the only mission to the lunar highlands. 17 had a tremendous destination, and they did it. and they had a rover, and they saw some fascinating scenery, and they had a lot of good science. So I would have loved to have done 17 again. It's the second flight. I couldn't break Jack Schmidt's leg, though. He wouldn't let me close to him, so I didn't get a chance to do it.
But Tom from CollectSpace, one of the forums, he's asked, does it get day go by that you don't think about, or even briefly, your very unique experience that happened to you on Apollo 16 going to the moon?
There are days that go by when I'm at home. You know, we have a lot of just activities of living at home in New Braunfels, Texas, and I have meetings to go to and business to go to and take care of. And so occasionally I don't think about landing on the moon, but then and if we got a nice moon in the sky in the evenings, it all comes back. So it's more days I think about it than I don't think about it.
Mm-hmm. You have an Australian connection that dates back to when you were in Apollo. Philip Chapman, who was an Australian-born astronaut. Could you tell us a bit about Philip?
Well, I didn't know him well. He was selected, I think, in the fourth group of scientists. And several of them never flew. I think they realized that Apollo was going to be mostly test pilots that were going to get those missions. I know his last name was Michael. I've got a mental blank now of his first name, but he went back to Rice University as a professor. And he just decided that he'd rather be teaching. And I don't remember why Philip resigned and before he got to fly, but he did. But I'm going to see him this year. We're having a 100th anniversary of the founding of the aeronautics department at MIT, and they're having a big reunion, so he's going to be there.
Terrific. Just two more questions and we'll let you go. This one just came in this morning and I haven't had a good chance to check it, but Lou Chennell from CollectSpace, after all the mission rules, when it came down to the wire, did you land with helmets on or helmets off?
Everybody landed with helmets on. We were completely gloved. We had gloves and helmets on the ship system, environmental control system. And the reason was if you touched down and the window popped out, you wanted to be able to survive. So anytime like when you undocked, you had helmets on and you were fully suited. Anytime it was something where you could lose pressurization due to an impact or a hard landing, or the undocking command module and lunar module, you were completely suited with gloves and helmets so that you would survive.
Well, although something surprised me, most of the Apollo crews landed during reentry with helmets and gloves on.
Oh, are you talking about reentry?
No, but I just that's a different phase.
Right.
Of
we
the
didn't
mission.
Have no suits on for
really?
Reentry. We were in our constant wear garments. And so the suits were stowed, and all the helmets, gloves, everything was stowed under the seats. And we just came in constant wear garments. So.
Mm-hmm. Terrific. Well, last question. People may be familiar with the From the Earth to the Moon series that ran a few years ago. And one of the scenes out of that was one of the episodes was about Apollo 16 and Ken Mattingly losing his wedding ring in the spacecraft. And it actually floating out of the hatch during his EVA, and I believe it floated past you and you grabbed it. Is that correct?
Well, I saw it floating out the hatch, and we'd been looking for this thing for 7 days or so, and I was down in the lower equipment bay, and when I got I was wedged in, and by the time I broke loose and floated after it, it had already gone out the hatch, so I reached for it but missed it, and. So it slowly drifted out. The relative velocity between the spacecraft and the ring was just almost nothing. So it took about 3 minutes to float out about 3 meters and hit him on the back of the head. Amazingly, it took a 180-degree bounce and came back towards the hatch. It took a 3-4 minutes to come back, inside, and it floated right in front of me in the LEB, and I grabbed it.
Oh, what a great
story. It was an amazing story.
It just sounded so much like Hollywood, but it was true.
It was true.
It's terrific.
Unlike gravity, some of the things in gravity you can't do, but that worked.
Well, I think, Charlie, we should let you go because you've had a long day and a long week. Really do appreciate you coming in and spending time with us.
Well, Andrew, Peter, I've really enjoyed being with you all. We had a nice dinner together the other night, and thank you for your support of the space program. Australia has probably one of the most active support groups of space, and we appreciate it. Thank you all for all you've done and all your work on Apollo Lunar Surface Journal and the Apollo Image Gallery. That's really meaningful stuff. So I thank you for it. Good to be here with you.
You've got an open invitation anytime you're back. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you for joining us on the Space Show, Charlie.
Appreciate it.
There was a conversation between Peter Owad and Charlie Duke, the 10th person to walk on the moon. Now, if you'd like to hear that again, or if you missed and would like to hear the first two chats with Charlie, then we invite you to visit our website. Now, tonight's program won't be up until next Wednesday at the earliest, but you can hear the other two. They're already up on the website. So visit www.southernfm.com, so all one word, lowercase, .com.au/space, SPACE. So that's www.southernfm.com.au/space. I'm a gonna raise a fuss, I'm a
gonna raise a holler. You can hear all the best music from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and today. Whether you like pop or rock, classical or jazz, Southern FM caters for all music tastes from every era. Tune in to 88.3 FM on your dial to hear the hits, the great hits of the past, present and the future.